Words on Water.
Hi, welcome to Words on Water, a podcast from the Water Environment Federation. This is Travis Loop, the host, and I am in the desert today. I'm in Phoenix, Arizona, and I'm here with Catherine Sorensen, the director of Phoenix Water Services. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Welcome to the desert.
Yeah, I'm happy to be in the desert. I was flying in yesterday and just enjoying watching the Southwest landscape, out my window, and it was very interesting coming into the Phoenix area and starting to see pockets of water, different bodies of water, the canal kind of lines, and you know, obviously I saw some pools and different little reservoirs and that type of thing. So I'm just so curious about how water is collected and managed and distributed and in the desert. So glad to chat about it.
Likewise, yeah. And we're glad that you're here visiting us.
Could you give kind of the quick overview of Phoenix Water Services and how many people you serve over what type of area?
Sure. So Phoenix Water is the largest potable water provider in the state of Arizona. We serve around 1.6 million people, mostly in the political boundaries of the city of Phoenix, but also in the town of Paradise Valley. And we also actually provide wastewater treatment services for about 2.5 million people in the Valley of the Sun.
Okay.
Through a partnership that includes the City of Phoenix, the City of Mesa, City of Tempe, City of Glendale, and the City of Scottsdale as well.
I thought that was very interesting that wastewater side of the house was done in that collaborative kind of five municipality arrangement.
Yeah, I think there is something about the value of water in the West that lends people to take advantage of the economies of scale in the industry and to plan regionally and cooperatively. And that's really been the history of both water and wastewater planning here in Central Arizona.
And I also noticed that you have over $4 billion of infrastructure investment coming up over the next 10 or 11 years.
Yeah.
So definitely some big projects on tap.
It is. It's a very large utility. We cover about 540 square miles. We have an enormous distribution system because Phoenix is not a particularly dense city. Downtown is dense and becoming denser, but over that service territory, we have about 7,000 miles of water pipelines. We have 5 water treatment plants, hundreds of pump stations, PRVs, wells, reservoirs, steel tanks. It's a really large system. But one of the things that is most interesting about it to me is the number of miles of pipeline. So to put it in context, I said we have 7,000 miles of water pipe in our distribution system. That's roughly the same number of miles that the city of LA has as well.
Wow.
But if you think about it, they serve close to 3 times more people than we serve. And so it's important to keep in mind that as those pipes age, as they reach the end of their useful life, our citizens are going to have to pay collectively to replace that infrastructure. And that's a large task over so many miles of pipeline.
Let's talk about the landscape here in the desert, hot and dry. You gave a presentation this morning and used that phrase a lot, understandably. Describe that. What's it like being in a place that's hot and dry? And you also talked about the drought situation.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting. So like I said earlier, the city of Phoenix, we don't really have natural disasters the way that other communities have natural disasters. We don't have earthquakes, no volcanoes, no blizzards, no tornadoes. I wish we would have a blizzard, but we don't. So we don't have that experience, but what we do have is hot and dry. And hot and dry is unrelenting and pervasive, but you can plan for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of feel like compared to some communities, we actually have an advantage out here in the desert because you can plan for hot and dry. Mm-hmm. You can plan very methodically for it. And that's really what the city of Phoenix has done over the last 100 years that we've been a city, is plan to mitigate and be ready for drought, because it's our reality. We are in year 18 of the current drought. We don't know if it's year 18 of an 18-year drought or year 18 of a 100-year mega drought.
Yeah.
We obviously have to plan as though it's year 18 of a 100-year mega drought.
So that phrase mega drought really refers to the duration of the drought versus the intensity. It's more about it being long lasting?
It can be both. But yeah, I think it is meant to convey that, yeah, this thing could go on for a century.
You also talked about some of the water resources out there in Arizona and just the condition that they're in as far as the Colorado River being pretty over-allocated and Lake Mead levels dropping and the Colorado River Basin aridifying.
Yes,
is that the right
becoming
phrase?
Becoming more arid, yes.
Becoming more arid, yeah.
Yeah, that is a huge challenge for us. And to put it in perspective, about 60% of the water that's used in Phoenix actually comes from the Salton Verde River waters, which are local rivers. And a little less than 40% of our water comes from the Colorado River. Arizona has the lowest priority to Colorado River water in the lower basin states among Nevada, California, and Arizona. We're the first to be cut back in times of shortage on the Colorado River. So that's a real challenge for us, and it does appear as though shortage is coming. Like I said, Lake Mead water levels are dropping, the river's over-allocated. But the good news is that we've been planning for that for decades. We've been banking currently unused Colorado River water underground in our aquifers for decades. As a region, Central Arizona has stored up millions upon millions of acre feet of water in our aquifers so that we can be ready for when shortage comes.
That's incredible. So I guess this leads me to something else you talked about was paper water and wet water.
Right. It's a confusing concept for people east of the Mississippi, but it's really important out here in the West. So in order to make use of water, obviously you need to have real water, wet water. That means it's physically available to you, but it also needs to be legally available to you because water is so scarce here. You can imagine there are many claims oftentimes on the same drop of water. So you have to make sure that you have the legal right to the water and you have the physical availability of the water. Those two things have to be in concert with each other. Otherwise, you're not able to deliver the water you need to your customers.
So I was in a ride yesterday, Uber ride, and the guy, I told him I worked in water and all that stuff. And he said the one thing he knows about, two things he knew about Phoenix is that people use less or more or less water than they did 30 years ago or whatever. But then he also said that there's enough water underground to last X number of years if it was needed.
He's correct. And I'm glad to hear that our message is getting through. So Phoenix is located where two of the largest rivers in the state come together, the Salt and the Verde Rivers. And Phoenix is built upon a vast alluvial plain. And so over the eons, those rivers have deposited just a vast amount of groundwater, an enormous amount of groundwater underneath us. So that's the good news. The bad news is that it's a fossil aquifer. And by that, I mean that it doesn't recharge naturally with any significance.
Interesting.
So if you pump it out, you lose it. It isn't naturally replenished. So that means that it's really incumbent on us to manage it wisely for the long term. And fortunately, we've done that. Like I said, we've been banking water in these aquifers for many decades. Aquifers across the country are in decline, but ours are actually healthy and improving because of this wise water management. But that is super important. When you're dealing with a fossil aquifer, once you use it, you lose it. And we want to make sure that that aquifer is available for future generations, because if this drought lasts for 100 years, we need to make sure they have access to that water as well.
And so by banking water, explain that. What have you been doing to take care of the aquifer there?
Right. So there's a couple of different ways that you can recharge the aquifers. One of the most common here in Arizona is we find land close to a riverbed. Normally, most of our riverbeds are dry. And you scrape off the top foot or so of the topsoil. And then you use it as a spreading basin. You can dump water onto that basin, and it seeps naturally into the aquifer very effectively. The other thing you can do, which is common across the country, are direct injection wells. And we employ both.
I know. It was very interesting you talking about that aquifer issue. So that's kind of like your emergency reserve.
It is.
That's really the idea here is that's a source of water for a real desperate time of need almost. You want to keep getting it from these other sources.
The other thing that your Uber driver mentioned, which I think is really important, is that water use here in the desert in the city of Phoenix has become far more efficient than it used to be. Our residential gallons per capita per day usage of water has fallen roughly 30% in the last 20 years. We've really focused kind of on two things. One is we make sure that our water rate structure is such that it's strong. It gives a good price signal for conservation. It signals the scarcity of the resource. We charge more for water in the summer than in other months. And it's the summertime when you potentially need more water for landscaping purposes. So by charging more in the summer, people get a very direct price signal. Hey, you might want to think about converting from grass to a desert landscape. And that's exactly what we've seen over the last 30 years. We have some really interesting statistics on this. So if you go back into the early 70s, like when I was growing up here, pretty much everyone had a yard. That was just how things were back then. Upwards of 80% of single family homes had grass. Nowadays, in the city of Phoenix, we estimate that the percentage of single family homes that have majority grass landscaping is down to about 14%.
Wow.
It's been a huge change. Yeah, right?
That's a major drop.
It's a major drop. And we see that in our water use statistics as well. We serve 400,000 more people than we did 20 years ago, but with the same amount of water. So we've really managed to decouple growth from water use, which is really important for our economy.
And here I was interacting with a regular old citizen of the area who was aware of that change.
That's great.
Too.
I'm really glad.
And you know, you use the phrase desert lifestyle. So that's kind of a mindset that you try to instill in folks.
We do. And I often get asked the question of, well, why doesn't Phoenix have, you know, mandatory restrictions on water use? And really, we've tried to avoid that. Like I said, we've tried to focus on a good price signal in our water rates. But like you said, we also have tried to focus just on culture change. We don't feel that short-term reactive strategies are going to be effective. We want to look out for the long term. We want people to understand that if you're going to live here, you're going to need to change your mindset and embrace a desert lifestyle. Our customers have been very responsive to that, and the numbers really bear that out.
And I guess, you know, you even shared a picture during your presentation, a photo, you know, you talked about your family hiking in the Superstition Mountains, and you showed a photo of your daughter discovering some water during the hike and, you know, kind of just being drawn in to just walk through that water because the realization of how precious of it is.
Absolutely. You can't be in the desert very long before you just understand that water is a matter of life and death. It's our lifeblood. It's the foundation of our public health, our economic opportunity, and our quality of life in the desert.
It also, I guess, leads into one thing you said is you guys were One Water before One Water was cool, right? And that Phoenix really first delivered reclaimed water back in 1971. So what's the history there?
It's a super interesting history. It dates back into the 1960s when we were first building, you know, the more modern wastewater treatment plants. And we came together as a region, which I think is fascinating and really does speak to this idea of economies of scale and the value of water in the desert. So the cities of Phoenix, Glendale, Tempe, Mesa, and Scottsdale all partnered together to build the largest wastewater treatment plant in the state. The 91st Avenue Wastewater Treatment Plant. Phoenix operates it, but it's jointly owned. We began reclaiming wastewater and delivering it for reuse almost immediately. So yeah, we were One Water before, you know, the One Water phrase was coined. Much of that water actually goes to much of the reclaimed water goes to the Palo Verde Nuclear Power Plant to the west of Phoenix. It's one of the largest nuclear power plants in the country. The reclaimed water is used for cooling purposes in its cooling towers. And if it weren't for the availability of that reclaimed water, the plant couldn't be there. It's the only nuclear power plant in the country not located on a major body of water. It can only be there because of our reclaimed water. And I think that's a really fascinating example of the nexus between water and energy that is so important in this country.
Yeah, that is an incredible example. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about the reclaimed water was the Tres Rios wetlands. I mean, I've definitely heard of that years ago.
Yeah.
And tell folks what that is about. It's really, it's an oasis in the desert, right?
It is. It's so back in the mid-80s, we had a choice as a community. We could either build traditional brick and mortar infrastructure to kind of polish our reclaimed water for additional reuse, or we could build green infrastructure. And back then, of course, we didn't really have that phrase, green infrastructure, but that's what it is. So the wetlands actually help polish the reclaimed water naturally through the ecosystem. And then we maintain that ecosystem. We help maintain it. It's really fascinating. So not only does it help clean the water, but it's just created this incredible oasis for wildlife and for humans. We get fishermen, hikers, every kind of animal you can imagine, beavers, bobcat, coyote, javelina, bald eagles, every kind of bird. I mean, it's an incredible place. You can imagine that water is just so precious out here, that any place that has water is just an attraction for living things in the desert.
Sure. How large is that area?
Oh, heavens. I want to say the treatment portion, I believe, is 90 acres, but I may be wrong about that. Okay. But then the water flows over into the recreational overbanks and kind of creates a nice meandering stream. And that goes on for quite some time.
Wow.
Really popular among birders. If you're a birder, you want to go there. It has an incredible number of species. And most of the people that go out there are birders.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard that that's even a tourism driver, is people mm-hmm. that are into birds come here to Phoenix to go to that area.
That's right.
I guess a little bit of the historic piece you talked about too, and this is something I saw from the plane, was the canals piece.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about how, you know, Native Americans hundreds of years ago, you know, even came here for the agricultural value,
right,
and created canals. And
right.
That has carried over into modern day.
Yeah, the ancient Hohokam Indians first settled here thousands of years ago. They carefully chose this place because it is where two major rivers of the state come together. And they quickly figured out that using the natural elevations of the Valley of the Sun, so the Valley of the Sun is higher in elevation to the northeast and lower in elevation to the southwest, that they could carve out an intricate canal system, divert the flows of the river, and irrigate their fields. And they built a thriving civilization here. So yeah, agriculture has been practiced here for many, many hundreds, if not thousands of years. What's fascinating is that we still use that canal system to this day.
Wow.
It is the foundation of how we move water in modern times as well. Yeah. So it's a really interesting connection to the ancient community that was here all the way to modern times.
It's amazing. And so, I mean, I guess one of the things I saw was a canal coming from the northeast and coming towards the city area. And
right.
So what river was that probably?
So that's probably the Salt River Project canal system that brings water from the Salt and Verde rivers down all the way into downtown Phoenix, all the way into the western parts of the Valley of the Sun.
Yeah.
The other major canal system that serves us, of course, comes off the Colorado River mm-hmm. system. So yeah, canals are still the foundation of how we manage water in the Valley of the Sun to this day.
That's incredible.
It's how we move water. Yeah.
And so there's not really issues with evaporation or whatever as that water comes?
Certainly, there's some loss to evaporation, but it's just one of the most efficient ways to move water. I always find it fascinating to think back that, you know, the Hohokam Indians were doing it here in the Valley of the Sun, but people have been moving water for thousands of years.
It's amazing.
Right?
Yeah.
It's an important part of the human heritage, of what we've inherited from ancient civilizations. Turns out humans are really good plumbers, right?
And still using just the natural forces of gravity to move that water, which helps with the whole energy efficiency.
Sure does.
There. Well, one of the other areas I wanted to talk a little bit about, since we're here actually at WEF's Biosolids Conference, is biosolids mm-hmm. and biogas and kind of what you have going on here in the Phoenix area. Some really interesting numbers and projects there.
Yeah, so we produce a tremendous amount of biosolids from both the 23rd and 91st Avenue wastewater treatment plants. And we're lucky because Central Arizona has a strong agricultural presence. There's a local market for those biosolids, so we are able to beneficially reuse pretty much all of that in local non-food agricultural crops, which is really incredible.
Yeah.
So yeah, it helps us with resource recovery. We don't have to landfill that. We avoid the costs of hauling it. It's a really great partnership.
And you were also talking about how the sun that you have here is a nice help in processing those biosolids.
It is. So we take those biosolids. They, of course, run through centrifuges, and we dry them out to some extent. And then we haul them out into drying beds, which are just large concrete basins on the 91st Avenue wastewater treatment plant property. And we let the sun do its work.
Mm-hmm.
We're able to achieve reductions in volume of like 50, 60%. So that means that when it's hauled away, it's that much less material, that much more efficient of a fertilizer. So it's pretty cool.
And then you also have some exciting developments, I think, going on the biogas front.
That's correct. So we're really excited about this, and this should happen literally any day now. And when this happens, when we open the biogas plant, that means that every single resource that comes out of the 91st Avenue Wastewater Treatment Plant, all the water, all the biosolids, all the biogas, will be beneficially reused. We're super excited. We partnered with Ameresco. They are building a biogas facility on the 91st Avenue Wastewater Treatment Plant property. They will clean the gas, and then they will put it in a pipeline and ship it straight to the green energy market in California, where they can really get a premium price for it. We expect that we will make about $1.2 million a year in profit on this venture. And like I said, it's just a great way to use the product and help save planet Earth in the meantime.
Yeah, that's incredible. That, I mean, just the fact all the water is getting reused, mm-hmm. all those biosolids are going to be reused, all for beneficial purposes. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the resource recovery model at work right there.
We hope so. We're really excited about this.
The last thing I wanted to ask you about is a fun form of resource recovery, I think, in both of our minds. Arizona was home last year to the Pure Water Brew Challenge. Mm-hmm. And I'll let you go ahead and describe what that is and what it was like to have that happen in Arizona.
So this was really an incredible effort. There was a contest. A nonprofit foundation was offering a prize of about $300,000 to garner innovation in water in Arizona. And so there was this huge contest. Pima County and Tucson came up with the winning entry. And what it was an idea to take reclaimed water from each of the major plants in Arizona and then have a contest among the brewers here in Arizona for who could brew the best beer with it. I'm sad to say that Phoenix did not have the winner, that actually it was a brew house in Tucson, and good on them. They won the contest. But really what it did is it just opened people's eyes to the possibility of direct potable reuse and what that really means. And what better way to get people used to drinking reclaimed water than through beer? Because everybody loves a beer, right?
Yeah, sure.
And it was tremendously popular, hugely successful all over social media. And I think really helped people understand that these products are safe. They have a place in our future. This is where the industry needs to go. It was a great effort and we're very proud of it.
I know that it's gotten national attention. Mm-hmm. You know, there's been some of these pure water brewing efforts in other states, but this was really the big scale where I think 26 brewers participated in it.
Yep.
And so I think states and breweries around the country have taken note and are interested in bringing similar competitions to their states. Mm-hmm. So like you said, this will just help keep raising public awareness about water reuse.
Yeah. There's something about beer, right? People come together over beer.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Catherine, thank you so much for the time. Great conversation. I feel like I've learned so much more about how water works here in the desert. And thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Words on Water.